are now listening to Jason Horsley, the podcast In Between the Liminalist, talking to Gabriella Coleman about Anonymous. So we only have an hour.
Yeah. Otherwise, my dog's gonna rebel.
Right. You wouldn't want that.
No.
All right. So let's get right to it then. Okay. Because of that, I'd like to, rather than talking about the book or about the mechanics of Anonymous, we'll just assume familiarity with the subject matter and jump in at the deep end, if that's all right with you.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So I'd like to start with this notion of the hive, like Anonymous as a hive, and if you what you think about that, and if you could describe the ways in which you agree or disagree with that.
Yeah.
That concept.
I'm not a total fan of that concept, mm-hmm. because it just seems to imply that it's a little bit swarm-like and mindless, I think, or a mm-hmm. collective mind. And the image I like, which I'm not sure if I actually used in my book, but I use it in my talks a lot, is a hydra. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like the hydra is because it kind of appears like there's one body, and there kind of is at some level, just because of shared iconography and some shared ethics. But then there's many different bodies, you know, and by this I mean many different snakeheads. And they're kind of like often at war with each other and not in agreement. And you cut off one kind of head, but you can't cut off, you know, it doesn't destroy the whole body, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the image that I think is a more appropriate one for Anonymous. Now, I understand why people use the hive, mm-hmm. just because there are swarm-like moments, you know, where an operation is called and all of a sudden something like a bunch of killer bees show up or whatever. And mm-hmm. so it kind of like makes sense, but I think like if you're then really approaching it with an eye towards, you know, a broader picture, I think, yeah, the hydra works better.
Are you familiar with this book? I haven't actually read it, but I'm familiar with the thesis of it, The Wisdom of Crowds.
I don't think I've read it either. I'm more familiar with, I think the thesis.
Right. Which is something like, I'm on Wikipedia now, a central thesis that a diverse collection of independently deciding individuals is likely to make certain types of decisions and predictions better than individuals or even experts, draws many parallels with statistical sampling. So my sense of a hive is, I guess it's related to that in terms of the intelligence of the hive is perhaps infinitely, I don't like that word because it's never accurate, but enormously greater than that of the individuals or even the sum total of the parts. So that's my kind of intuitive sense about Anonymous when it works, that there's a kind of innate intelligence in all of us that is able to emerge when individuals get together to a common purpose and kind of improvise, I guess, or play, like something emerges through that spontaneous process of play. That's my sense of hive, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I wouldn't want all political activity to be that way. Sometimes I think it's better to have a smaller group of people who are in control of things. But I think actually with protest, which is a genre of political activity, mm-hmm. it's really important to have a lot of room for spontaneity for different reasons. And obviously then the hive is kind of helpful for capturing that. Mm-hmm. And the spontaneity, I think, is helpful for a few reasons, one of which is it's unpredictable, right? So spontaneous actions are hard for authorities to predict. Right. That's one reason. The other one is precisely like the sense of freedom and play, right? Because it's emerging spontaneously, not kind of from sort of I mean, coercion is not the right word here. I'm kind of blanking on what the right word is. But sometimes, yeah, you do need organization for sure. But sometimes if it's all about, you know, highly structured things, it's a bit oppressive, right? So
maybe contrived, would that be a
yeah,
word?
Yeah, contrived could be a good word for that. So, but I still think, like, you know, there's a little bit of too much emphasis put on these. It is, there's many, many elements which are spontaneous. I don't want to deny that at all, right? But at the same time, that spontaneity works and can only work because of some forms of kind of stability, you know, whether it's small teams who work together, infrastructure like IRC, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I just think in the popular kind of imaginary, it's always the spontaneity that's what people gravitate towards. And I understand that, but I think it's good to be counterbalanced by understanding the kind of, I guess, you know, kind of structural conditions that allow for spontaneity.
You used the word liminal, I noticed in the book, maybe just a couple of times, but you also talk about the liminal kind of nature of anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with it in anthropological terms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, I kind of bring up the trickster and liminal, but I don't bring in Victor Turner, you know, all sorts of people that obviously were my silent interlocutors. But it wasn't an academic book, so I kind of kept that stuff away. But certainly that was the theoretical material that influenced how I was thinking about Anonymous.
Can you say a bit about it now, then?
Yeah, I mean, I think the trickster is generally a liminal figure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a liminal figure precisely because sometimes you don't know what to think about them, right?
Mm.
It's things are not clear cut. And I think the whole history of Anonymous, especially like that, you know, when you take like pure trolling to the activism. Mm. But then even just the activist domains where the trolling has been, I think, significantly subdued, right? But nevertheless, not to the extent where there aren't these kind of morally ambiguous moments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one really, really important aspect to Anonymous. And one of the things I tried to kind of convey, although I don't know if I did like such a great job at it, is that, you know, I think that there's a way in which we think trickster, oh, we must celebrate the trickster because it's the trickster, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's not so much about just like celebration. First of all, I think like the trickster is both with us as, you know, certain living figures, you know, like, you know, comedians, you know, like Colbert and Jon Stewart, you know what I mean? But it's also a character that is just kind of very immemorial, and I think for good reason. But the whole point about liminality in one aspect, I mean, I think there's many different aspects of it, is that for me, the whole point is that you have to be forced into thinking whether you agree with something or whether you don't. You can't do it from the outset, you know? And it's precisely because things are morally ambiguous that you're
right.
forced into thinking about those ethics, right? And it puts you in that liminal zone. And that's why I think Anonymous is a trickster figure, you know, is precisely because of their kind of Janus face or their many faces, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not kind of always so clear cut. So I think that's one element that I think is really important. It puts us at that, you know, it forces us towards that moral threshold, right? And another part that I also think is interesting is that I mean, this is more about the trickster than liminality. I mean, the trickster is a liminal figure, but something that I do think is really, really important about the trickster is that I do think that rules and norms in societies are incredibly important, you know, and yet if they dominate 100% of the time, you know, things become incredibly calcified and ossified, right?
Mm-hmm.
To an oppressive degree. And so we need zones, and these, I guess, are liminal zones, liminal spaces, where people are okay with breaking rules, you know?
Right.
And, you know, Anonymous, for better or for worse, is one of those kind of characters and has created one of those spaces and places where that's happened, you know?
Yeah.
And this is another reason why I think of them as kind of valuable in certain ways, but it is also very discomforting at times.
Yeah, well, it would have to be.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And what you're describing there is very much the anthropological meaning of liminal, in terms of that transitional space in a community for in which a rite of passage occurs, and in which all of the social rules are temporarily suspended in order to initiate the new generations into adulthood, and they, of course, will be the new rule makers. So the thing about suspending structures and institutions and laws and values so that something new can emerge in that liminal space or from it.
Right. And it's interesting too, because this is, you know, not a traditional society where Anonymous is simply like the youth that then grow up to be the adults. But I think they're creating, yeah, this space for internet people, let's just say. You know what I mean?
Yeah, although a lot of them were young, or are young.
They are. I mean, it's between, roughly 18 and 35.
Hmm.
I think a lot of people think that they're just like 18 to 25, and it's a little bit more elastic than that. You know, obviously you don't have too many people over 50. That's a much smaller number.
Hmm. But there probably are some under 16.
Oh, yeah, that. Yeah, for sure, yeah. For sure. And there's, you know, one of my favorite characters was Tiflo Mustafa Al-Bassam, who was 15 when he started Internet Feds, and 16 when he started LulzSec.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that one thing I've said recently, and not in reference to Anonymous, but just generally, is it's kind of a ditty or whatever, fortune cookie thing, but reducing it down to the essence, is that once something becomes a movement, it ceases to move. And I relate this to liminality again, which is there's this space between structure and, well, liminality means anti-structure, right? But it's not the complete rejection
no.
of structures.
It's kind of reconfiguration of it.
Yeah, so there's an acceptance that there is some need of structure for something even to exist, like to communicate at all, we need language. So, or at least to communicate certain things, we need language. So, but at the point that we become restricted by our language, then we can't even think about things we don't have words for, and then it's time to go into that liminal zone and let it all come apart. And with Anonymous, it occurred to me, I mean, it's maybe very obvious and been said many times, but that there's this kind of paradox in that when Anonymous became a movement, it was named, and so in a certain sense it ceased to be what it was the moment that it was recognized.
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, there's one quick story that might interest you, and then I'll get to this question of movements, because let me start at the beginning. So, you know, actually trolls who were very unhappy that Anonymous kind of morphed into activism.
Yeah.
Continue to troll, but they now say we can't even use a name. We're
right.
nameless, and not the name Nameless, right?
Yeah.
It's like
right.
no exactly. name. Because yeah. precisely once you become named, you can become stabilized or yeah. corrupted in ways that we don't want, right? And I found that just super fascinating, because I was like, yeah, what are happening to the trolls on 4chan? And then I contacted people who spend a lot more time on 4chan than me, and they were sending me some screenshots of this stuff, and it kind of makes sense. And so I think it precisely is a great example of what you're talking about. That said, I think that certain movements, you know, move more or less, you know, and precisely there is a kind of like dynamism and flexibility to Anonymous because it's an open source name.
Right.
And so it has mutated a lot, has moved a lot in ways that have surprised me. And I never really know what to think about what's going to happen, you know? If you had sort of told me, for example, when I was first looking at Anonymous and their protests against Church of Scientology, I would have been like, oh, this will never become anything more than this. This was a bit of a historical mistake. The conditions were right. And the next thing you know, new node to support piracy. And then I would have been like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, Anonymous is going to be like the name used for internet protests, you know?
Right.
And then next thing you know, they're getting involved in social revolutions. And so I think that you're right, naming things does stabilize them. But in comparison to many other kind of movements, they become a bit more stabilized because along with the naming, they have manifestos, they have charters, you know what I mean? These sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And without these, Anonymous is left a little bit more unhinged. Mm-hmm. And it helps explain the kind of mutability that has been part and parcel of its short, but, you know, whatever, 8-year activist history.
8 years, 2008 to 2016.
Yeah.
But how many years was it fermenting before that? I guess nobody really knows.
No, I can't ever get like a very specific answer for the... Definitely by 2005-06, there was trolling under the name, but it could have been happening earlier.
Hmm. So yeah, let's go to those kind of unmapped origins a little bit. While I was preparing for this interview, I went to your Reddit thing, and that sent me to this Adrian Chen review of your book, which wasn't very friendly, and I didn't find it very convincing in many ways. But I did. It did strike me something that he pointed out, which was the Petri disc, let's say, in which Anonymous emerged from, in which the original viri kind of formed, was what. Well, of course, the internet hate machine, it was it's very id-like. It was this eruption of all of these unconscious or suppressed urges, many of which were hateful, destructive, violent, ugly, appalling, and intentionally so, often intentionally so. And I did feel... Right. And I do think that that's really fascinating, and I did feel I would have liked to have had more of that in your book, because to me it's kind of like... Well, the manure in which the flower grows is of course indispensable. So actually, somehow that there's a fascination in that. Like, how did something that most, well, maybe not most, but many people would see as a positive force for good, however temporary and fleeting, emerge from something that most people would see as in entirely negative terms? And I think there's something very rich in that. That really you can't have one without the other, and that what we think of generally as entirely destructive or undesirable, which of course is the id, the stuff we suppress, that is the only fertile ground there is for intelligent action to emerge from.
I mean, I'm not sure I would say it's the only one, but I do think it can be an important one. And I also do think that if it's, you know, this is like just classic Freud, if you totally repress it, you know what I mean? And don't have spaces where it can be played out. I think the dangers can be even worse, right?
Yeah.
And then finally, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, not all spaces of idness will necessarily lead to something that we might find acceptable or progressive, right?
No.
And then it's interesting to think about why this space. And, you know, I've thought a little bit about it, and I'd like to think a little bit more about it. I certainly do think that, and I hint at this, but having spent time on 4chan, I do think that this is part of the dynamic that, there was an odd egalitarianism, or there isn't a strong egalitarianism on that board. You know what I mean? Where people are like, look, it's not who you are and your background and your pedigree and your degrees. It's what you say. It's what you say that matters. And the board technically enforces it, right? There's like really no way around it. And I think definitely in a society like ours, where, the whole point is to get individual recognition at minimum, and then, if not that, celebrity, there's something really incredibly powerful about that idea that's literally practiced all the time. And I think that egalitarian ethic, which people like self-consciously talked about on the board, right? It wasn't simply that it was sort of existing at a kind of subconscious level because of practice, but it was practice, and then people talked about it. I think that did help, kind of allow for the id to then kind of be transformed in certain ways. And there's probably other elements. I think humor is probably another one too. There's something incredibly powerful about humor. And again, humor is a very double-edged sword, right? It can be used to really degrade and punch down, and the trolls do that. But it's also this incredibly strong social binder. And it's compelling and attractive, and people pay attention to it, you know what I mean? And can also be very much tied to, these unrestrained forces, right?
Yeah, I was going to say it's very spontaneous in its essence. A laugh is spontaneous, and real funny humor is spontaneous,
That's
I
right.
think.
And actually, in my first book, I have a whole chapter on hacker humor. And I claim in the chapter, first of all, I'm interested in why hackers are so into humor, and I kind of explain why. But then I kind of say, the clever joke, even more so than any elegant hack, is undisputed. And it's undisputed because at that moment of execution where everyone laughs, you don't then just go, well, you know what? I actually don't think that was funny. Like if you laugh, that's the end of the question. Whereas even with a really nice piece of code, you'll have like 99% of everyone saying, wow, that was amazing. And then there's still this one guy who goes, you know what? I think that there's a better way of doing it, and disputes it, And so like a well-executed piece of humor or joke, it's just not under debate. You just laugh. It's very spontaneous, and it binds everyone together.
It's also very ephemeral. You just move
That's
on. It's
right.
not like you can them and sell them, or
Right.
they don't really have any inherent use unless you're going to write script for a comedian, I
Right,
guess.
right. No, exactly. It's totally non-utilitarian,
So this whole notion of expression of the id and the different forms it can take, and I would say the necessity of it, is one that's very close to my heart. And one of the things that I believe in my own life is that it is, and this is about liminality again, that space in which it's safe to express whatever it is, no matter how taboo, that unless we feel free and safe and relaxed enough to let our ugly side of the id show and clear that out, then the good isn't going to emerge either.
Right.
But so there's something in your book about the I mean, it's very obvious, but you underline it towards the end about you juxtapose the how being anonymous on the one hand frees one up from name faggery, the attempt to make a name for oneself and care about one's image and all of that. So in that sense, it frees one's expression from the constraints of ego, let's say, or self-image. But how the flip side of that is that there's no responsibility or accountability, I should say, because one could still be responsible. And so those two sides are also that's also in what I'm talking about in terms of the id, that you have to be able to let go of the the desire to be seen in a good light as well as the fear of being condemned. Both of those have to go, and then what emerges is I would say it's from a deeper place than one's identity, from one's socialized identity. And so in that sense it is a pure expression, and in that sense I guess nameless and faceless, being a bit poetic now, but
right, no, absolutely. And I mean, again, there is some forms of accountability, you know, but they are far more minimal. The activist wings are more pseudonymous. People have been unmasked, so there's a recognition that may happen, right? Yeah. But nevertheless, it is very, very different. You know, speaking with your legal identity right from the get-go versus not, as we're learning this week.
So it occurred to me before talking to you that, again, it's very obvious, but I hadn't really thought about it, the emergence of Anonymous into the public realm due to Tom Cruise video.
Yeah.
That's a very much kind of a literalized representation of how Anonymous is the shadow of celebrity culture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the thing that triggered them,
so to speak. That's right. Yeah. Like, you can't get, you know, more of a sort of crystallized celebrity than Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah.
And then having him be part of the Church of Scientology, which geeks and hackers kind of can't stand, on top of it, because it's, you know, a religion of unworkable technology and fake science.
And then the church attempting to suppress the video because of Cruise's image.
Exactly.
Image control, that whole thing. And then, of course, the Streisand effect being that the attempt to suppress that or to control the image was exactly what provoked those forces that would sabotage those attempts. So it's totally it. It's the more you suppress it, the stronger it gets.
It gets, right.
Fascinating. We're about half hour mark. I don't usually go this fast. I usually like to keep these liminal and just see where they go. But I feel that I might not get another chance to talk to an anonymous semi-insider, so I want to make the most of it. I've got a couple of actually written down questions, which I never do.
Wow.
But so I'm going to hit you with them, and hopefully they'll be fruitful. So here it is. To what extent did Anonymous cease to be what it was? Oh no, I've already done that one. Never mind. Next one. Anonymous emerged from a very specific social technological petri dish, 4chan. To what extent does that petri dish still exist, and to what extent a similar embryonic or uncrystallized pre-cum Anonymous clusters is still occurring? Did I rephrase that? Was that
comprehensible? No, yeah, that is. I mean,
okay.
I think I had answered a little bit with that kind of, tidbit that the trolls are still acting with no name, but like yeah. really no name. And then also harder to kind of identify and follow in certain ways, but nevertheless around. I think though, from the perspective of Anonymous, right? You know, there's a way in which, I didn't even think about this until just this conversation, but there's a way in which, like, the let's call it that id force, works at different registers and levels. Mm. You know, one in 4chan was just this kind of, like, unconstrained force where, you know, every rule was there to be broken, every norm. And yeah. again, Anonymous, it was somewhat contained, but then especially in 2011, one can say the kind of the id that was most operative was that kind of like being okay with breaking laws, you know? It's just like, we're going to hack this and that and that, and we don't give a shit. You know what I mean? Like that was, that's kind of incredible as well in its own way. Like maybe, you know, they're not using like the N-word or anything like that, but you're like, Sony, who gives a shit? We're going to hack you. Fox News, you know what I mean? And that's why I think, wow, that was so unbelievable. And it just felt very, spontaneous and creative. And I think in the context of the English-speaking world, that stuff is totally muted or gone, you know? Mm-hmm. And it is alive in Latin America, in the Spanish-speaking world, very much so. Because those countries don't kind of have the resources to go after people. And they've also become a bit smarter as well, the hackers, where there's a division of labor, where it's like, okay, you live in this country, we won't have the hackers hack against anything in this country. You know?
Oh, yeah.
We do it in another country and we coordinate. So I think that there's still this kind of energy there. But it's, you know, also not being covered, which is probably better for their own kind of self-protection. But certainly in the English-speaking world, that kind of like, you know, uncontrolled urge and then execution of breaking, you know, laws was definitely muted or stamped out or eliminated in a way that, you know, for much of 2011 and 12, it was just out in the open, uncontrollable.
Right. No, but also co-opted in the sense that, for me at least, I mean, and I'm a card-carrying paranoid and always have been so, but I think for many people becoming more and more so with all of the evidence emerging to be paranoid about. But in terms of Anonymous, like how can we separate Anonymous as a genuine spontaneous movement of individuals, wherever they're located, but you know, for reasons emerging internally, from externally manipulated
right.
intelligence ops?
Sure, of course.
And you know, how soon did that start? Because it's easy to imagine that as soon as some awareness developed of what these kids were doing, I'll call them kids, whatever, that intelligence agencies would pay attention immediately and think, well, not just how can we stop this, but how can we recruit them? How can we learn, you know, what can we learn from these kids in terms of upping our own game?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I do think we are in a little bit of a weird moment where the intelligence community is a little bit concerned that there will be others like Snowden, you know what I mean, who will leak information about them. And I think that may be the only reason why they're a little bit more contained, you know? I mean, for example, in the Snowden leaks, we had the fact that GCHQ like DDoSed anonymous servers, right? And that's actually not that controversial. It's like that's the sort of shit that they're gonna do. But like, you know, whether or not, like, I thought a lot about this, like, would they implant individuals? You know what I mean? And actually direct things. Yes, I think like historically we have enough information to know that this is totally possible. But I think there might be a little bit of pause knowing that within their ranks are many geeks and hackers, not many, but some who might be willing to step forward. And then if they reveal that, oh my God, that's just like reputational total damage. That said, I actually like interacted with one person anonymous quite a bit who I was convinced was CIA. She was just so smart, and she just had such fantastical stories about her life, and also claimed she was in law school. She was always fucking online, you know what I mean? And so either she was like a really crazy brilliant person, you know what I mean, who was like living with their parents because they're crazy but brilliant, or you know, was working for CIA. It just made no sense. But yeah, I mean, I think that what you say is very kind of very real, you know, and there's only like a little bit of maybe restraint today at this moment. I think they'll figure out how to deal with it, if that makes sense.
How do you mean? What
Well, like the
restraints and
restraint of like if we have a bunch of implants, then there might be a whistleblower, you know, today who reveals this, because we're in this weird moment of leaking, you know?
Well, that's true, but that could also serve certain ends in terms of just sowing more and more distrust
True.
within that community.
Yeah.
It occurred to me there's a kind of possible overlap in terms of the moral ambiguity or this liminal twilight zone that some anon participants exist in, even though, of course, there's a strong ethical thing, and maybe we get to that, with anyone who's going to work for intelligence agencies, in terms of it's a moving line, you know, what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
And certainly the higher up you get in that system, it seems to me that the more that line moves and eventually disappears entirely. That didn't lead to a question.
No, it's just everything. I mean, I think that these are really important to entertain, and historically, we have enough evidence to know that this is always a possibility. I just then, it's so hard because then you are at this level of like total conjecture, you know?
Yeah, and
And
suspicion and
suspicion,
distrust.
distrust, and it's frustrating. It's frustrating because also one of the things, like, I mean, I tried to defend some of the like hacks, you know, against Stratfor, HB Gary, which seem like insignificant, you know what I mean? Because in comparison to like the break-in by the Citizens Commission to expose the FBI, which basically revealed COINTELPRO or whatever, you know, I'm just afraid that a lot of there's obviously government stuff, but then there's also corporations going to security industry, and then the government's also contracting to security industry, you know what I mean? Who are each doing a little bit of motherfuckery. You know what I mean? That doesn't look very significant on its own, but it's only an aggregate. You know what I mean? And it's just frightening to think about that because it's almost then impossible to reveal that, you know? Unless, again, like hackers are breaking into 150 security companies and finding evidence of that, you know?
Yeah, well, it, I I mean, of course, that whole apparatus of control and corruption itself is impossible to get one's head around. But I also, and maybe everything is when we go deep enough into it, but with Anonymous, I'm more aware of that feeling of almost recoil when I try to think about Anonymous or that phenomenon. It's just so difficult to make up one's mind about it, which I guess is its power to a large extent. But specifically, I mean that for me personally, like I'm very one of the things I appreciate about this kind of phenomenon is its id-like nature, is its taboo breaking, is its total disregard for the kind of neoliberal mindset that I feel is horrifically oppressive right now, as oppressive as any kind of government regime, frankly. So I really love that there isn't a moral or an ethical basis to it. But I also love when I see that somebody's actually acting in a way that is challenging, really horrific acts or agendas or the rest of it. And I'm somewhat dedicated to exposing those things, although not, I should say, as an attempt to bring about social change, but just for my own kind of journey of understanding. So it's kind of like whenever I look at Anonymous, I keep swinging back and forth. Like, where's the exact point of balance between lulls and ethical action, let's say. Because it seems as though that's the point that, and to me it does come down to the spontaneity. So if you're in it for the lulls, although according to Chen, lulls has quite a negative connotation. But anyway, if you're in it for the sheer enjoyment of it, and that encompasses confronting corruption or deception, as it does for me, what I do, I enjoy it, entails that. But you don't get pulled into the moral faggotry of I'm going to bring about change, or I'm better. Then that somehow that in that space, it seems as though actual change can happen. And maybe it's because of what you were saying that you can't predict it and you can't map it. You can't collect the data and then anticipate how it's going to behave.
That's right. I think that's a really big part of it because so many things have been sort of stamped out precisely by mapping, infiltrating, understanding it, you know? And this is also why I try to kind of argue that we need these forms of kind of secrecy to some degree. Again, I wouldn't want like everything organized in that way, but we're really shortchanging ourselves if we don't. And in some ways, governments rely on that secrecy to be a step ahead of the game, right? So we're going to
Totally.
relinquish all of that to them. I mean, that's ridiculous.
It is. I mean, it's unrealistic, but then, of course, then there's the battle not with monsters, lest you become a monster conundrum, right?
Yeah, for sure. And this is where I think, like, the fact that Anonymous does have some norms or ethics, right? I mean, it's the id doesn't in the activist realms just totally dominate, right? It's there and it's embraced and it's valued, but there's norms in play, and that allows for some degree of control, right? But it is scary. Like, I sometimes think, like, for example, my book came out right when Gamergate was happening. And I was not sure at that point whether the name Anonymous was going to be like recuperated by the trolls. And I thought it was totally possible. You know what I mean? And in part because it's like, yeah, this name can go in different ways in different directions. And so it's, again, its powers, its unpredictability, but I could imagine in 5 years, like the name being used for stuff that I'm not really okay with,
Right. Well, I was hoping that something would emerge spontaneously in
Yeah.
that dead air, but I'll have to go
I
back
just
to my
thought there was another
script.
question.
Well, there are, of
Yeah.
course, but I
That's
have one written down, but I was hoping for a spontaneous one. So, kind of continuing from that question about this Petri dish, well, I mean, because it's different in the widest sense, of course, the anonymous emerged via the internet. Narrow it down a little bit, it was via 4chan, which is not so much a technology as a forum, as a space on the internet. So, actually, I suppose in the very widest sense, we're talking about computers. And one thing I was wondering about is, the medium being the message and all that, like how much what did emerge was shaped by the technology through which it emerged, and how much there might have been an attempt to, well, kind of inescapably, I think there must be an attempt to prevent something like that emerging again. Or the next phase of it, which could be even more disruptive, and whether the part of the ways in which that were attempted to prevent that were shaping the technology in different ways. So now you've got kids on their iPads, and everything's on the cell phone, and just the way that people interact with internet has transformed very rapidly. And I'm wondering if that would actually shut down in some ways the avenues for this kind of id energy to emerge as freely as previously.
So I think that there have been different moments in the history of like network technology, that have been particularly fertile for this sort of stuff. And like BBSs were definitely one of them, And BBSs were just like these little ponds, and I mean it really seemed like a true underground, and so far it was like much harder. I mean, some were very public, but many were really word of mouth, and you had to be invited, you know what I mean? And it just was so great for the creation of the Hacker Underground, And Bruce Sterling, actually, in this book, The Hacker Crackdown, he doesn't like really pose the argument intellectually, but pretty much through his storytelling, kind of said we wouldn't have the Hacker Underground in the way that we did if it was not for the BBS, And I think that there's a similar way which the image board, especially the anonymous image board, but not only the anonymous image board, kind of is a different but similar set of kind of technologies and conditions, that also kind of help explain the constitution of anonymous. And I think so long as we have an internet where people don't have to ask permission to create new software and new technologies, and they can just go ahead and do it, I suspect we will in the future have another kind of place like the BBS, like the image board, you know what I mean? Where this story will happen yet again in a similar but slightly different way. Now, the second things become like super regulated on the internet, where one has to ask permission to connect to it, and that's a totally possible, future scenario. Then it's totally game over, right? And so I'm currently not totally pessimistic about it, just because I think that that internet of, being allowed to kind of connect to it and create certain spaces, whether it's the Silk Road or anonymous image board, still exists, and people will kind of flock there, like a group of humans will go there. But I could imagine the internet of the future being quite different, where that is not possible, where one has to register, one has to put in your license, one needs to get permission from the powers that be, and then that will be kind of the day that it ends. But then you could imagine independent networks as well, that are not on the internet, and that might be a place where that happens.
Do you mean like darknet, or you mean entirely separate from
In
computer?
entirely separate, like I'm thinking of sort of like there's a big mesh network in Spain, GuiFi, and it's its own network,
But it's hooking c computers
It
together.
is, yeah, it's still computers. It's just not connected to the internet. Or
So it's just a separate internet, really.
exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know people who don't stray from, and I think it's more and more true actually of people, but I know people who are actually afraid to stray from certain trustworthy sites. So, of course, more and more people, when they log on, they just go to Facebook and that's it. But I mean, even people who are wanting to find out the news and stuff, they will just only go to the officially sanctioned sites, New York Times, whatever, and they consider it actually dangerous to stray to any of these unauthorized sites because they might be ingesting all kinds of conspiracy theories and end up anti-Semites or who knows what might happen to them, you know, if they allow that stuff to infiltrate them. Seriously, I mean, I do know people who think like this. So to that extent, it's almost as though there's a subtler way of controlling people is getting them to regulate their own ability to question or their willingness to explore, and particularly if you have laws like it never occurred to me that this might happen, but you mentioned somewhere in the book that it was somebody was in danger of being prosecuted for linking to a
Right, Vera
website.
Brown.
Right.
Yeah, that was, and he in the end wasn't charged with that, but he did end up in jail for 5 years, and the judge allowed that knowledge to be used for the sentencing, which is fucked up.
So, like in the real world, we have areas where it's more or less safe to go, and then you have areas where if you go, your chances are you're going to get in hot water one way or another, and you might get arrested for trying to buy drugs, even if you're not, just because you're found in that zone. So it could be a similar kind of thing happening with the internet, with the increased surveillance. Even if it wasn't happening, just people's paranoia about if they click on this site, it'll be forever on their record, kind of thing.
Sure, and they did. There was a study that showed that people were visiting certain web pages in Wikipedia less because they were like about terrorism and stuff like that, I think. Which just shows, that people are concerned about being tracked or associated with these things, And I don't question that that's happening. But I don't think it's gonna, totally get rid of these underground scenes so long as certain technological conditions are met. Like, is it gonna marginalize those groups or, are they gonna be small? Yeah, probably. And that's again what's so weird and interesting about Anonymous, I think, as well, is that a lot of kind of like similarly spirited groups, like up your wall, motherfuckers, and stuff like that, were like a kind of small vanguard, if that makes sense. Whereas this is like one of the first kind of manifestations of something that kind of, was initially marginal and esoteric and became weirdly big, So that was also what was kind of fascinating about it.
The way that it expanded into the public sphere, or what specifically?
Yeah, that exactly. It really permeated public consciousness. And of course, I mean, V for Vendetta had a big part to do with it, right?
Yeah, well, now we've got Mr. Robot, which, of course, is. I didn't carry on watching it after the first couple of episodes, but it seemed like it was. Well, certainly it was representing the anonymous phenomenon. I
Oh
don't know how
yeah.
favorably, but it seemed like glamorizing it to a large extent, I would guess.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, I think actually I'm writing a bit of a paper about this right now. I actually don't think this is a bad thing. Just insofar as one of the ways that the US government has really controlled radical phenomena in this country, like here I'm thinking about the environmentalists, is by framing them as eco-terrorists. And if you think about it, like eco-terrorists are not represented in popular culture very often. And if they are, it's like pretty negative. And now here's anonymous and hacktivist being kind of lionized, you know?
Riotized?
No, lionized,
Oh, lionized,
yeah.
right. Yeah, yeah, sure. But it can, I mean, that can, A, it can have a backlash, and B, that can be part of a larger complex, which is also congruent with the riotization, with the demonization. Like Native Americans, of course, were lionized at the same time they were being slaughtered, right? So
yeah.
And autism also is that phenomenon. You've got the indigo kids on the one hand, and the, you know, the soulless monsters to be euthanized on the other.
No,
kind of thing.
Very true. It's not unilateral, and there's different forces at play, you know what I mean? But I actually still think that it's generally a little bit more positive. And then, of course, it helps that people like, you know, Snowden are well respected generally, you know?
Yeah, I'm on the fence about Snowden, and we're just nearing the hour, so it's a big, we won't be able to start on this subject, but I'm still on the fence. The fact that there's a Hollywood movie coming out about him and that he is a public hero, frankly, makes me suspicious, I have to say. Because I just think there's a kind of damage control that is practiced in terms of things are coming out and things are becoming known, and so there's a way to direct it in terms of a certain figure gets chosen to be the one to represent that, and you've got a TV show, and I mean they can't appear to be entirely draconian, the government. It has to appear to be, in some sense, allowing for the emergence of these things, is my feeling. So I just tend to distrust. Once it's becoming part of the mainstream narrative, I tend to suspect that it's already been rewritten severely.
Yeah.
Like I said.
I mean, yeah, I'll have to wait to see what the movie's like and what the effect is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, what are you exactly suspicious of?
Well, I would make a fool of myself if I tried to talk very specifically about Snowden, because I don't know the details. I just watched the documentary, and that's about as far as it goes.
Okay.
But just I consider politics to be theater, and I think that the level of event manipulation is pretty vast and intricate, is my sense. And so when a major figure emerges in a way that has that shakes the foundations of society, not to exaggerate, but whatever, to whatever extent it stirs things up, then the question does always arise for me, you know, what if that's a plant? What if that was staged? And I'm not saying that it was, or that I believe it was, or that I have evidence. I'm just saying that that's something that I would really want to ascertain and to question and to look at all the different indications. My sense is when somebody really does emerge and or try to get something done that's completely independent, that they just get squashed out very, very quickly. That's my sense. But you know, as I could say, I mean, my paranoia is cell deep, and I grew up in a family where the deception just was so prevalent. It took me 40 years to realize it, so I can't tell how much of that I'm projecting onto the world. But I know there's many out there in Anon who do feel similar ways in terms of the extent of social engineering,
right,
and how deep it goes, and really like not to trust any of the figures that are put forward, I guess is what it comes down to.
Right. Right.
The leaders and the heroes that we're given.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that there's a way in which not everything is manipulated, but since we never know what is and what's not, you know what I mean? It's difficult then to know what to trust. I mean, and here, like, just one very little example is, like, for example, Jeremy Hammond, who is doing a 10-year jail sentence. I mean, when I was interacting with him, he's so much like an agent provocateur, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just felt like he was too extreme. He was pushing people. I knew he was pushing people, actually. People told me. And so I was just incredibly concerned in a lot of ways. And as it turns out, he was the real deal. You know what I mean? It's really hard to tell these things. And it's not to say that there, and of course there were informants in there, and who knows who else was in there. But that's the point, you know, like not being able to know or judge.
Of course, I never heard of Jeremy Hammond until I read your book. I say, of course, because as in he's quite marginal compared to Snowden.
Right, right, absolutely.
Speaking of historical figures, what's up with Julian Assange right now? Like, where's that at?
Well, he is still in the Ecuadorian embassy. There's a big event coming up with him, actually. Where all these very prominent people are going to be speaking on his behalf, you know, to get him out. And that's about it that I know, you know.
And he's not allowed on the internet? Is that sorry, I shouldn't laugh. But
he's on the internet for sure.
Oh yes. Yeah. I was gonna say, I mean,
He gives talks as well. So he gets beamed in and gives talks. He's fairly present in certain, you know, areas or whatever. But yeah, it doesn't look good in terms of him getting to leave the embassy.
Stretch his legs a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrible. You remember when The Matrix came out?
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a life-changing movie for me, for better or for worse. It occurs to me it was quite prescient in terms of how the heroes of that movie were terrorists because they were hackers. Which, I mean, it wasn't really a very strong meme back then, was it, in 2000, 1999? The idea of hackers as terrorists.
No. I mean,
And of course, the Wachowskis did V for Vendetta then, so.
Right, 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 absolutely. And I don't think that's the main narrative that people understand hackers as. I think it's totally possible in the future, though.
Hackers as terrorists.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that people are really buying into the war on terror, but I guess most people really are. And then basically it's that liminality again. If you sustain the chaos for long enough, people are desperate just for any kind of structure and direction and order. And so then, you know, they become more and more willing to embrace these draconian measures, and of course to demonize the other, anyone who appears to be threatening that stability that's already so tenuous.
Right, right.
So I think that those are the conditions under which it becomes possible for people to actually think of hackers as terrorists.
Right, right. I'll have to rewatch The Matrix. I haven't watched it in so long.
That's the end of this podcast. I'd like to thank my donators, Stephen, Paul, Jeffrey, Nolan, Robert, for your generous support. Next week I'm going to be talking to Jonathan Lethem about his upcoming novel, A Gambler's Anatomy. That's the Limitless podcast between at horticulture.com/limitless.